This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And, oh boy, I have something that's very timely today, and I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper Suzanne Shapiro Barash, and she has written a book that, I think all of you are going to want to read, and it is called A Passion for More. And Susan, it is so nice to have you on the program. I sometimes things are just so timely, and your book, which is called A Passion for More, Affairs That Make or Break Us, I think everybody's thinking about certain people who have had affairs. So welcome to Joy on Paper.
Thank you so much, Patsy. I'm really happy to be here and to talk about it. And yeah, this is actually a 30-year study, and the book is just out now about how conventional women really feel. I've interviewed thousands of women about this, a diverse group in terms of age, ethnicity, race, religion, level of education, what part of the country they live in, all over the country, sophisticated cities, rural areas, about this very emotional/physical need.
Well, I must say I found the statistics pretty shocking. So let's talk a little bit. People now, on the news every day, all day long, we're hearing about certain people, certain person, and I don't want to, get into that, but all of this has brought up the idea of affairs that have international implications. And then, of course, you've discovered so many that are very not famous, but boy, just tell us about this research and the percentages that you discovered.
Well, the first thing I want to tell you is that this is anecdotal qualitative research that I neither condemn nor condone, that I'm a journalist investigating this piece of pie in a woman's life, if she so chooses. And as I told you a moment ago, I wanted a very diverse population of women, and I was intrigued by how they felt. The categories in my book, the four types of affairs, really came out of the research. So I spoke with these women, and some did it. Let's talk about the sections, the four types. So some do it for sex, and it's called sex-driven affairs. That's pretty self-explanatory. But what's interesting is that these women do not want an emotional connection to the lover. And if it gets too messy in a way that we've heard men have operated in our very patriarchal culture for decades, centuries, then the women just move on. So those are really not emotional. And then there's the empowering affair. And when women are empowered, they're really working in a kind of male, universe where men earned a lot of money, as hopefully more and more women will do. And they could have sort of their flings when they traveled or do whatever they want. So women are saying, this is what I'm after, and I'm able to pull it off. And then the love affairs, which are the most poignant in my study, where a woman is really happy enough. She's married or she's in a committed relationship. Life is fine, and she, walks across the room at a party. She meets someone through work. She goes to a college reunion. And the kind of thunderbolt enters her life and changes the status quo. And then we have the self-esteem affair, and I find that really, in my latest research, relatable for women of all ages. And I do want to tell you that I interviewed women between, early 20s and their 80s. And so this is women saying, I feel invisible. I don't feel appreciated by my partner, my husband. I feel that I take care of children. I take care of grandchildren. I take care of my mother. I take care of a whole group at work. And what about me? And then the lover makes them feel really special.
Oh, boy. You know, it's so hard, really, to talk about it in because you did you figure out why? Let's talk, sort of divide them. You talked to women who had children and they had affairs. Did they respond differently from the women who, I mean, if you're married and you know, you don't have children, but the women who had children, did they understand the impact of what they were doing?
What's so fascinating is that women are very willing to take the risk for the reward. And they're really quite facile at balancing their lives. You know, already they're wearing so many hats. You know, good wife, good mother, good friend, good colleague, good daughter. And so these women are pretty compelled. I'm not here to say it's for everyone. I'm here to say that the women who so choose it feel very, very invested in the experience. So how do they pull it off? Well, you know, like one day a week, they're just with their lover or something like that. You know, it depends on how they structure it. And they, some women say that it really helps their marriages or committed relationships. That they're happier, and so therefore everyone else is happier who is, you know, involved with them. Husband, children,
until
sisters.
The kids find out, the PTA finds out, and then you're all over the net.
So. Well, I'm really glad you brought that up, because what happens with women, and, you know, I've written 13 nonfiction women's issue books, so one of my studies that I just want to mention that came out in 2008 is on why women keep secrets and how they keep secrets and lie for the cause. And of course, female infidelity is one way they do it. So women are pretty adept at keeping a secret. They're not quite as messy or sloppy as, you know, they describe men who have, you know, how they found out about their husband or a boyfriend. So the only reason for the almost my entire study that women reveal the affair to their husbands or partners is when they would like to use it as a negotiating tool. So they say, look, you know, I want you to know I was having an affair, but I really want this relationship to work, and I want us to be more intimate, or I want us to, whatever's missing from the marriage or the primary relationship is what the women look for in the lover. It's not like they're repeating their marriages. And what's interesting also is that the men are listening. Now, some women, you know, say to their husbands or partners, I can't be here anymore, and one reason is I've had an affair. But that doesn't happen as much. They're really very careful.
Well, just let's go over the statistics that you...
Right, my findings. Yeah,
the actual findings. Do you want to go through the numbers? Because I thought
I'm sorry.
I was shocked. I'm telling the truth. I was shocked.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with how women are positioned in our culture and how we envision and imagine women to be. That's what's so striking about it. And then you find these stats. So 70% of the women in my study, my ongoing study of 30 years, will have an affair at some point in their marriages or committed relationships. And when I say that, that includes a cyberspace affair, a virtual affair, an affair of the mind, an emotional affair. It's not just running to a hotel room with this other man. It's somehow crossing the line emotionally, or during COVID, there was a great deal of sort of women at home learning more about their husbands by spending all day and night with them, not just, you know, several waking hours. And realizing, you know, that maybe this isn't what they thought it was, or longing, you know, saying, oh my God, there's a pandemic, and, you know, what is regret, and why didn't I pursue that, you know, old boyfriend, and having access. So we're talking about 70%, we're talking about the kind of access women really didn't have before. our cell phones are practically private. You know, there's so many ways through online to find an old fling or to meet someone, and women really go after it if this is what they want. Okay, more stats. So 65% of the interviewees said that the sex was better with the lover than their husband. And many of these women had been married for a while, even 5-10 years. And then this is, to me, a very telltale statistic that I found. 78% say that their lover is the opposite of the husband. And I had mentioned that a few minutes ago. The idea that if your husband is very cerebral, then your lover is very physical, or vice versa. If your husband is your age, maybe the lover's older or younger, or, you know, he's an extrovert, your husband's an introvert. So women are looking for what they don't have. They're not looking to just have another man, but to have another kind of man in their lives. And then about half stay in the relationship after the affair and about half leave, which for a long time reflected the divorce rate in America, but now marriages are down and so divorce is down as well. And then 45% report the lover is the catalyst to leave and sort of a bridge to the outside world. But in my study, only 35% of the women ended up with the lover. And then 60% view the lover as an escape. And 70% think he's a wake-up call, which means it's about self-care and about soul-searching. And it's not just the lover, but how this woman has evolved. You know, so many women said to me, look, I'm not the young woman I was the day I got married. Or, you know, life has really changed me, and so I'm a much stronger person, or I'm someone much more aware of my own needs. So I'm hearing that, too. And then this is probably the most striking stat, that 90% of the women said they really didn't have any remorse or regret. They didn't really feel guilty. And the reason being that by the time they embarked on the affair, these traditional women had really been through something in their marriages, for the most part, except for the love affair. And then 50% report cyberspace affairs, and I mentioned that before, that there are all sorts of virtual affairs that go on.
Oh, boy. I don't know. I think that, you know, When we look at these numbers, you wonder why we have all these wonderful, beautiful wedding magazines.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good point, because we are all taught in our culture that there will be this prince who sweeps us off our feet and makes life better, and that marriage is a goal, and love-based marriage is riveting and expected. And then, you know, life changes us. Also, we live a long time. And over the decades, we evolve and our partners evolve. And do we grow together or do we grow apart? So, the intention of a love-based marriage is really, really compelling for young women still. And remarriage. But let's look at the stats. For remarriage, you know, the second marriages break up, according to, I think, CDC or census, at a rate of 66%. And third marriage is 73%. First marriage is 41%. So these are the latest percentages. You put it all together and you get like it's home, you know, about 50-50 that a marriage will last in America.
So, you know, what, in addition to the statistics, tell us some of the stories that you think will have impact. Now, you, as you wrote this book, you have also contributors who talk about the different aspects of this. But what do you think people will find from reading this book? Because it is fascinating, and reading the stories it gives you a lot of ideas for writing a cozy mystery murder. But
well, right. Oh, and that's really something that I've found all along the way, that when we read a novel or we read a mystery, or we read a love story, or we watch a limited series or a movie on Netflix, and there's an affair, we understand it. It's dramatized, but when one is reading real life stories where the women have changed the identifying characteristics, but the story that they tell is exactly as it is about their experience with their lovers, you know, with their lover, then we're really talking about something almost like a documentary. You know, it's very different. And so some of the most memorable, well, they're all really important, and I so appreciate that the women came forward to share their stories. And what do we learn? Well, if you know anyone who's having an affair, possibly you want, one understands it better, you know, free of judgment and more about the longing and the yearning and what's missing. You know, why don't women leave marriages in many cases? For financial reasons, because of children, because of religious beliefs. So, you know, there's really a lot to it. It's multi-layered. But the stories that are compelling across the board, a young woman who feels very pressured by her family to get engaged to a certain man, but really loves the man she met in grad school. A woman who is in her 40s and meets a man at work, but they both have these families that they're very obligated to, and they took their marriage vows, but they're madly in love. A woman who feels really emotionally and, you know, really emotionally neglected and very unhappy in her marriage, and meets someone at work and never planned an affair. I don't think anyone walks down the aisle saying, gee, I wonder when I'll have my first affair. So a woman who meets a man and he really shows her what she can and cannot have in her marriage and is almost a journey for her to then, you know, decide to leave. So these are the kinds of stories. A woman who has no sex in her marriage, you know, we think of Lady Chatterley Lover, Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence, you know, but the idea that she could have sex and be still happy with her husband and get it elsewhere. So these are the kinds of stories that I've uncovered.
Well, the stories are fascinating. As I said, it will give, I think, all the writers here a lot of ideas. And I think, although there's, how can I say, there are cautionary ideas that can come through here, I would suggest to people that they really, really take these numbers in and see if they want to be part of this numbers game. And I don't understand how, like, does the danger of disease affect them? Does the danger of getting pregnant by their lover, does all of this play into this?
When I remember, as I said, this was my very first book, and I started doing the research in 1991, 92. And so I asked women about AIDS then. I asked them about, you know, I've always asked, are they worried? They're very careful. And as I said earlier, they're really compelled by the experience with the lover. So this is what the women who engage in an affair feel. This is their point of view that I'm reporting.
Yeah, okay.
And, oh, do you know what I did want to tell you?
Yeah.
It's going to be a podcast on February 14th with iHeart Podcast.
Okay, yeah, tell us that, the details. So it's, yeah, I knew that was going to happen. So it's going to be a podcast, and it's going to be on the 14th, did you say?
The 14th of February.
For Valentine's Day.
Yeah, Valentine's Day. Yeah, and it's called She Wants More.
And She Wants More.
And it's based on my book, A Passion for More.
And they'll be able to find that on iHeart Radio.
On iHeart, and Joe Piazza, the host of several podcasts, will be the host.
Okay, well, that will be interesting. Great.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so happy, and I did not realize when I was given your, you know, this book and the offer for this interview, I did not realize that you were the Susanna Marin who wrote the Palm Beach stories.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah,
Palm Beach
scandal.
I read it. You know, I don't know. I your publicist didn't know about me at the time when it came out, because it came out, I think, in 2020. But I read it, And I thought, oh, I loved it because, you know, I'm in Florida, and so I gravitate to anything. And, you know, I don't know. I was really very pleasantly surprised to find out that you're also, you know, a novelist, a great novelist.
Thank you. Yes. So I write under my pen name for fiction, Susanna Marin. And my novels are based on my research for how women truly feel, you know, the faces we wear versus how we really want life to be.
That's what I thought when I was reading the book, that I kept reading these stories. I kept saying, I could do a book with, I could write a murder mystery on this one. I could do it. So, yeah, exactly. You actually, you know what you're writing about. So, you know, Susan, it's great to talk to you. I'm so glad that you were on today, and people will think about the current situation, the guy in the news, and who resulted his whole life was traumatized by affairs on both sides of his family. So people take it into consideration. But the book is fascinating. It's called It's a Passion for More, Affairs That Make or Break Us. And it is really interesting. It's available online. And you also have a website. Just tell us your website.
Either Susanna Marin or Susan Shapiro Barish will get you there.
Okay. And then for Valentine's Day, look out for that iHeart Radio, iHeart Podcast, and it's going to be fascinating. Again, Susan, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's nice. That's interesting. Please, people, please think about things before you jump in. Yeah, before you jump into bed, think about things. The ramifications are terrible, as we now know from this big news that we're listening to all the time and we can't avoid. Okay, let's play a book buzz from Bria. I'm so happy always when Bria does her sci-fi book buzzes because she has such a wonderful voice for it. Let's go.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2022 Goodreads Choice nominee, The Mother Code by Carol Stivers, with stellar narration by Sunila Nankani. The 2020 release is available in print, ebook, and audiobook. Now, let's download the book buzz. A virus decimates populations all over the world, and a team of U.S. military tech experts execute a plan to save humankind from extinction. Their solution involves genetically altered embryos immune to the virus and artificially intelligent mothers who can carry and deliver the babies. In the event of human extinction, these mothers must be programmed to raise the only hope for the future. A colonel's fateful misstep changes the course of humanity, and the dual timeline fast-forwards to a harsh desert region where a robot mother called Rosie raises a child who knows no mother but her. As the past and future collide, a new set of challenges emerge, a battle for human survival and the unexplored bond between a child and his AI mother. This thought-provoking and richly scientific debut novel grapples with questions of motherhood while exploring human survival in a post-pandemic world, creating a cathartic experience for readers. Author Carol Stivers received her PhD in biochemistry from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and went on to postdoctoral work at Stanford University before launching a career in medical diagnostics. Her combined love of writing and her fascination with the possibilities of science brought to life her first novel. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3255. 3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar. Go savings. Go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Anika Savoy, and the name of her book is The Ghost in Her. Hi, Anika. Oh, she's not on yet. Okay. Big Ed is waving to me, and she's not on. I don't know where she is. Well, it doesn't matter, because any minute I am going to get a call from AAA, and I was going to have to interrupt the interview. So hopefully she's going to call in a few minutes, and then I can talk to her about her book, which is set in New York. Or otherwise, I'm going to... Ed, if I have to break up this... Are you listening to me, Ed? If I have to break this up, play a song, pull out a song, pull out, I don't know, pull out one of my songs that I love, because if she doesn't show up and I have this problem with AAA not calling me back, I might be on, I might even just have to jump up and go outside and see the AAA guy, because I've got a problem with my car. Okay. Anyway, is Anika on now? Anika, are you there?
I am here, Patsy.
Okay, Anika. I was just saying that I've got a problem with my car, and I'm on holding the line, my phone with one hand, and talking to you.
I'm so sorry.
So listen, if I really, it's seriously, if I have to talk to the driver, tell him how to get here. Oh, and you know, this is one of those days. I'm sorry about that, but I am happy that you're on, because I love The Ghost in Her, which is, of course, I love all books set in New York.
Me too.
I am a New York person. When I you know, mm-hmm. as a little girl in Northern Michigan, I used to dream about going mm-hmm. to New York, New York and New York. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I find a book set in New York, and you have, and particularly historical mm-hmm. ones, where we bring in all the history of it. So, mm-hmm. you know, this is just perfect. So tell us about...
Yeah, you know, Patsy, well, when I'm so much like you in that way, that New York City is my favorite city in the world, and I live in Connecticut, so it's just a train ride away. So I go at least 4 times a year, and sometimes spend an overnight, and there's just so much to do. It's such a rich, culturally rich place, and it always brings me out of the doldrums. A trip to New York City, there's nothing like it.
Oh, that's true. And then when you add in the aspect that you brought in, taking mm-hmm. it back in time so that we mm-hmm. we hear about all the things in the names that we recognize, and I love to learn the history of the people who built New York.
Yeah, you know what I try to focus on the book, in the book? It's the Ungilded series. That's the name of the series. And this is book one in Ungilded. So I took the term gilded because I'm fascinated by the Gilded Age and the luxury and the exorbitant wealth. But what I wanted to explore was the ungilded aspect of that age. The fact that just that very few top percentage points of Americans lived that way. And everybody else was like a working class immigrant in New York City. And life was very hard for these people, you know, and especially in the Bowery District, which I write about. Where there were fight clubs and brothels and, you know, all these different immigrants of German and Irish and Chinese descent. And they're all melded together in this great melting pot in the tenement district of New York City in 1888. The dark side to it all, though, is that if you're a young woman in that scene, like my heroine, Maggie O'Connor, she's a poor Irish seamstress. You know, you are really vulnerable in that environment. It's a very dangerous environment for a woman to be in back then.
Well, I must say, your first chapter is 4.5 pages. And mm-hmm. the way you wrote it, it is like a whirlwind. I was like, I was holding my breath, one thing after another. I thought, oh my goodness. And it was really it was a thrill. You know, when you get something like that, that just 4.5 pages, how an author can make 4.5 pages just zing. So that I remember when I got the book, I read that. And then before I went on, I said, I just have to read that again. How did she do that? She took my breath away. So I reread chapter one. It is great.
Yeah, I believe that you have to grab that reader from the first sentence. And if you don't have them in the first few paragraphs, you don't have them for the rest of the book. So that first chapter is so important. And I love to start with intense action. Ooh. And in that first chapter, we start with Maggie and her sister.
Oh, no.
You don't want me to share it.
Absolutely.
You don't want me to share.
Don't do that. No, this is what I don't like that. Because, I mean, that was what hooked me.
Great.
You know, if I didn't, you know, you get into books and, you know, I get so many books and, you know, I get sometimes a great first sentence, a great second sentence, but it's rare that I get a first chapter that just stops me in my tracks. And I said, how did she do that? It is just so good. And
thank you so much.
I don't want you to tell anybody anything. People, get the book, for goodness sakes, just get the book and get as excited as I did about this first chapter. And then you'll continue.
Well, let me just say this one thing about the first chapter, okay? I hope you'll allow me this. One thing is that for me, aesthetic and ambiance are just as important as plot and character. And so that's what I really wanted. I wanted to paint that scene.
Oh.
And you'll notice in the book, throughout the book, the moon, the stars, the sunrise, the sunset, all of these astronomical things are very much part of the story and the ambience of New York City.
Exactly.
I
will tell you, all of my listeners know, and this is so funny, I'm so happy you used the word paint, because I get this question from all of my listeners, and they'll send me emails. They say, how can I make my books better? How can I do, you know, a better job? How can I improve? And I always say one thing to them, paint me a picture.
Yes.
So this is my advice. Ever since I've been doing this show, that's what I've advised people. And so and you did that exact thing in this first chapter. I was like, I was there. I was on the street. I was holding my breath. I couldn't breathe for a minute there. There were a few times where I was like, I'm in pain. I won't say why, but I was in, like, and it was so much fun. It was, I mean, it's not a fun chapter, but the thrill of a writer being able to do that to a reader, I think is terrific.
You know, I wrote it during the pandemic. And I also write nonfiction, true crime and whatnot. And during the pandemic, I was working on a true crime book, and I just put it to the side because what I wanted was to have some fun. I was just so bored, and everything was so dark and heavy around us during that time. And I truly just wanted an escape. I wanted to take my mind and the reader's mind on a roller coaster ride, just a magical, mystical, crazy roller coaster ride. And I hope you'll agree that, you know, the book is also, even though it's gritty, it's very whimsical. You know, there's a lot of comedy, and it doesn't really take itself too seriously, even though it grasps very heavy issues.
Exactly. And because there's a lot of darkness in it, but you need mm-hmm. you need that break from, you know, mm-hmm. you need the comedy, you need the humor, mm-hmm. and you've created that. And of course, that's New York. You know,
right.
That's part of New York. There's that darkness, there's all the gritty part of it, but there's also just sometimes just unbelievable things that can happen. I think about New York when I, as a kid, how I wanted to go there. And I actually landed up not going to New York. I landed up going to London. I headed over to England. I bypassed New York, actually, at that mm-hmm. time when I was young. Mm-hmm. But when I finally got there, and I did. There, literally, I sometimes just danced down the streets. I was so happy.
I feel the same way about New York. And what's great in researching for this book is that I visited New York City quite a bit and read a ton of great literature and nonfiction about the history of New York City. And there are so many places you can visit in New York City that take you back in time. Like, I went on the Bowery Tenement Tour Museum, the museum tour that they have of all the old tenements, the brick tenements in the Bowery District. And you see how the people lived in these little shabby, tight spaces that were poorly ventilated. And, you know, you can go on so many historic tours throughout New York City. I also went to Roosevelt Island, which I write about in the book, which is actually Blackwell's Island in the book. The name has changed over the years. And Blackwell's Island was where the New York City Lunatic Asylum was. So you can, you know, take the tram over the East River or take the ferry to Blackwell's Island, which, again, is now Roosevelt Island. You can walk through this pastoral landscape and imagine what it was like back in the late 1800s with the almshouses and the prisons and the insane asylum and the smallpox hospital. So it's just so amazing to investigate New York City's history in real time in our day and age, you know?
Well, so tell us, other than we're not going to say what happened in the first chapter, but you've come out with a character, and mm-hmm. we can talk about her and about the man, because I found mm-hmm. Him very fascinating, too.
Good. Yeah, I did, too. You know what? I'll say about the man in this story, Gershom Moskowitz, the one that Maggie falls in love with. He's Jewish, and his father immigrated to New York City when he was a little boy. And I purposely chose a Jewish hero because you don't read many romance books with Jewish men. And I'm fascinated by Jewish history. So I thought, let's make this guy Jewish. Let's make him an architect. So he's a real dreamer. And then Maggie is a poor Irish immigrant. She's a seamstress. Of course, she's devastatingly beautiful, right? And they fall in love. And she has this psychic gift of being able to see ghosts and talk to ghosts and see into the future. She sees fairies. And she knows she better be really careful about sharing this gift with others, because she runs into the danger that afflicted her ancestors, who had this gift of seeing, and they were labeled as witches, you know, and burned at the stake. And so bad things would happen to women back then if they started talking openly about these things. They could even get thrown into a madhouse. So that's the obstacle in Maggie's way is, how do you be a psychic? How are you a psychic and a seer in a world that doesn't allow you to behave that way and think that way?
And that's what makes the story so interesting. What you've done is you've brought this combination of personalities together, which I really enjoy, and I do love Gershom. I actually, it reminds me of a friend of ours. So I found him just a fascinating character.
Yeah. He ends up working for Carnegie.
Yeah.
Andrew Carnegie.
Yeah.
So he really gets lucky.
Yeah. That's what I liked. I really like that. Wow. It must have been so much fun to do the research on this, because the setting is 1888.
And do you know what? When I was starting to write the book, I was struggling with Maggie's voice, because as a poor Irish immigrant who was not educated, she would not have spoken like a proper lady. She would not have spoken in a way where she's referring to books. And so what I added into her character early on is that she's a very self-educated, self-driven, intellectual woman. Even though she's a working-class Irish immigrant, she has this love for literature and books. And it was in doing that that I was able to flesh out Maggie's character and have her fully come to life as a highly intelligent, educated woman who spoke well. She knew that if she spoke in a coarse manner, like the other immigrants in the Bowery, it wouldn't take her anywhere in life. So she knew she had to kind of recreate herself in order to rise above her low social position.
And when you were doing the research, I mean, there's so much between the people, the food, the food of the time. So you have a lot of that.
Yeah.
Just tell us what some of the research that you did. What did you find that really, really sort of? Sometimes isn't it just a little thing that you find that sets you off and gets you really excited?
Oftentimes it is. You know, you'll find this interesting. I got some of the food ideas from an actual recipe book from 1895 that was given to me by a homeless man at the library one day. He said he found it in the dumpster as he was going through the dumpster, and he asked me what I was writing, and I told him I was writing turn-of-the-century paranormal historical romance, and he said, I have just the book for you. And it was this book from the Waldorf chef, and it was the actual old 120-year-old book. And it had all the recipes of things they would eat back then. So I incorporated that into the story. Also, I have like old Montgomery Ward catalogs from the 1800s. I would draw a lot of the wardrobe fashion things from that old Montgomery Ward catalog. And then there were classic books like The Other Half, How the Other Half Lived. And that came out at the turn of the century. And it was all about how the working class in the Bowery lives in New York City. So those are just a few of the books. I did a lot of reading about Jewish culture in New York City at the turn of the century. There's one scene that involves a great blizzard. And that was an actual blizzard that happened in New York City in 1888. So I found a big picture book at the library about the great blizzard of 1888. And I drew from those pictures and those stories, you know, just the kind of mystery of how a city would clear out all of that snow before having, you know, plow trucks. And how did they manage a blizzard in New York City back then? So that's just a short sample of the research I did.
Well, it makes it so rich. The book is rich with this kind of detail. That's, I like when a story has layers to it, and so it's not not just one thing. There's all this depth to it, and you certainly have created that. So I think, you know, that this is just always so much fun when an author comes out with an idea for a new series, which I think you have plenty of stories to continue this series. And this is going to be lots of fun, and I always like to be in on the start of a series. So
yes,
It's fun.
The next book, I think, it's very much different from this book, but in many ways, I think it's even better. So I think the reader's going to be really pleased with book two, Mayhem in Disguise, because I take the nice Mohegan Irish nurse that helps Maggie at the lunatic asylum, and I make her the heroine. But Maggie will reappear in book two. Book two has to do with energy vampires. Book one was about ghosts, and it had a lot of Catholic Christian imagery. Book two will be about energy vampires, and it has a lot of Native Indian Mohegan spirituality.
Okay, well, you're having fun. I can tell you're having fun. The minute I read that first chapter, I said, oh boy, this girl is having some fun here.
I was. And do you know what one Goodreads reviewer said? You know, I really wasn't sure where she was taking me with this story, if Maggie really was a lunatic or if she was being wrongfully accused. And the truth was, in the first early months of writing it, I wasn't sure if Maggie was a lunatic. So I think that's why it was so convincing, because I was still thinking, maybe she is a lunatic.
Well, yes. That's what happens when you come out with a good character. Sometimes they take over and they do what they want.
They do.
And she certainly has. And I think you're delightful, and I'm just wish you the best with this series. I think we've got a lot of books ahead of us, and it's going to be lots of fun. And I must say, I will always remember your name, Anika Savoy. I know it's not your real name, but it's a perfect name for this series, because, of course, the Savoy Hotel, where I used to go to high tea. I said I moved to London, well, outside of London, but spent a lot of time in the Savoy Hotel. It was sort of, I decided to make it my base for when people came to visit me from America. Mm-hmm. So I would say, meet me at the Savoy. And after,
that's classy.
Oh, that was classy. You know, I didn't want to just meet them, you know, at the airport.
McDonald's.
Right. Yeah, just, I said, meet me at the Savoy. And they all knew me at the Savoy. They thought I was a crazy American.
That's funny. There's a lot of French in the book, because I was once fluent in French when I went to college in Montreal. I lived in Montreal for 10 years, and so I had 8 years of French instruction. So savoir means to know, knowledge, wisdom. So I also like that kind of, from the word savoir, Savoy.
Perfect.
That aspect, right.
Yeah, you've got it. You've got it, girl. I think you're great. Mm-hmm. I think you're fun. I'm looking forward. I'm looking forward. We'll have the you here for book two. And meanwhile, give people I'm not sure what your email.
I'll give them my website.
Yeah, your website.
Sure.
And because you have two names, I don't know what your...
Yeah, easy to remember. AnikaSavoyAuthor.com. On that website, you can see my fiction and also my nonfiction that I write under my real name, Ann K. Howard. I encourage your listeners to check out the website. And also, the audiobook is very well done, very well done. The woman has an Irish lilt that reads it, and it really brings Maggie
to life. I need to listen to that one. I love Irish lilts. They're my favorite.
I do, too.
I always tell Irishmen that I think they're so sexy, much sexier than French accents. I love Irish.
Yes.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah.
Like, it's Liam Neeson. He's Irish, right?
Yeah.
He's got the Irish.
Yeah.
Get out of here. Yeah. I mean, he just has to open his mouth, and I'm like, I love you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Hey, I hope your car feels better, Patsy.
I hope so. I haven't heard. They haven't called, which is a bad sign. I'm holding the phone. Stop talking to you. I'd just turn the whole program over to you.
I hate when you hold your breath waiting for them to tell you how much it's going to cost, right?
Oh, please. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to, I will reread the book. I will absolutely reread the book while I'm waiting.
Wonderful.
Okay. Thank you so much for being
Thanks
on.
Thanks so much, Patsy.
You're
Happy
so much
New
fun.
Year.
Bye-bye. Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Big Ed. Big Ed in the control room. Would you pull out the Ella Fitzgerald Manhattan song. I know I played it before. I played it when Doug Brunt was on the program for Ghosts of Manhattan, which is, by the way, I still think Doug Brunt's book about the Wall Street crash of 2008, which is called, I love that book. And he was one of my first guests, Doug Brunt. And I was happy to have him on. And we had, at the time, it was so cute. His little baby came on into the room. And that was really exciting for me. But we're going to go ahead and play Ella Fitzgerald, Manhattan, if you can find it. Because I know I played it and I love it. Did you find it, Ed? If you do, tell me and we'll go into it. And if not, I'll just keep chatting. I know that. There, everybody, bye-bye. I'm leaving. I'm going after my car. Enjoy this song.
The zoo. It's very fancy on old Delancey Street, you know. The subway charms us so when balmy breezes blow to and fro. And tell me what street compares with Mott Street in July. Sweet push carts gently glide.
Sometimes I feel like giving up and throwing in the towel. Sometimes I can't hardly face another day. I am assured that God will see me through. It's working for my good. It's working for my good. Sometimes the clouds hang low. I can't even see my way. I ask the question, when things will ever change for